The first reading this morning consists of two poems of the Hindu poet and singer Mirabai, who lived in the hot and dry Rajasthan area of North India at the same time as the Reformation and Renaissance were going on in Europe. These two poems form part of a corpus of only about 200 songs, which scholars consider to be authentically dated to Mirabai's time. Over 3,000 songs, however, are attributed to her.
Out in a downpour in a sopping wet skirt, and you have gone to a distant country. Unbearable heart, letter after letter, just asking, when, my Lord, when are you coming? Come, O aloof one, the sight of your body seizes me. My name? Call me the woman whom separation drove insane. Night and day you can see me, a fish thrashing on the shore near the water. Your servant Mira perishes at your feet, and yet she dares call you giver of all joy.
The second reading is a poem by the Buffalo, New York poet Carl Dennis. It's called Still Life. Now's a good time, before the night comes on, to praise the loyalty of the vase of flowers gracing the parlor table, and the bowl of oranges, and the book with freckled pages resting on the tablecloth. To remark how these items aren't conspiring to pack their bags and move to a place where stillness appears to more advantage. No plan for a heaven above, beyond, or within, whose ever blooming bushes rustle in the sea breeze at this very moment. These things are focusing their attention on holding fast as time washes around them. The flowers in the vase won't come around again. The page of the book beside it, the edge turned down, will never be read again for the first time. The light from the window angles, the sun's moving on. That's why the people who live in the house are missing. They're all outside, enjoying the light that's left to them. Lucky for them to find on their return these silent things just as they are. Night's coming on, and they haven't been frightened off. They haven't once dreamed of going anywhere. Nathan to play that tune, West Chase, because the title of the hymn that goes with it, which is in our hymn books, is called Bring Many Names. And it gives the title to this morning's sermon, even though we're not going to sing the hymn. I like the phrase, bring many names. Our religious education director, Jolinda Stevens, and I were lucky enough these last few days to attend the Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute's conference down at the Hyatt near the Capitol downtown. The conference was called Transforming Race, Crisis and Opportunity in the Age of Obama. It was the best conference I have attended of any kind in many, many years. On the very first night, I knew it was going to be dazzling. Look, I want you to see it. There we were, sitting at great round tables in the huge room down at the Hyatt. There were men and women of every age, every color, every ethnicity, every ability, every culture. People from all over the United States and from Canada as well. Different in skin color, shape of eye, texture of hair, accent, clothing, and identity. Distinct in profession, geographical origin, religious views, musical tastes, and class origins. Yet I recognized right off the bat that the eight of us at my particular table were in complete sync with each other, despite all of those differences. How did I recognize that? Because we all entered immediately into conversations with each other, and none of us held anything back. We spoke without jargon. We spoke without labels or assumptions. We put our feelings out there. We let each other know that we were allies in this great work. Oh, we were different in most every way, but because we risked conversing honestly and freely with each other, without shame, without hesitation or jargon or any easy definitions, we created community, intimate community, from the very first moment. And I have to say it felt terrific to be in that company at that time. Later, I sat around another round table at a different session with a different set of people. People different from each other in every way, just as at the first table. Yet even though we were different, when I looked around, everyone was nodding, yes, 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 as the sweet and beautifully wise John Powell was speaking. John Powell runs the Kerwin Institute. He organized the conference. And he spoke openly and clearly, remarkably clearly, of his own refusal to ever use jargon or easy labels. He told us that he finds it far more helpful in his work to speak of patterns of racialization in society rather than to sink ever to calling anyone else a racist as individuals, and he said, for any reason whatsoever. Calling someone a racist, he said, shuts down communication. But communication, he affirmed, communication between us is the point. Of course, he added, there will be little progress in dismantling the racialized structures in our society unless we feel free to talk with each other about race without tiptoeing around the room. If we feel free to talk with each other because we are encouraged to do so frequently, risking both discomfort and deep challenges to our habits of behavior, both conscious and unconscious. But if we start off by stopping the conversation, he said, that can't happen. Everyone at my table was overjoyed to hear his homily. Now, of course, those gathered at the conference, admittedly, were self-selected. You actually don't rush off to become part of such a conference if you happen to think that Rush Limbaugh is the greatest living exponent on race issues. So admittedly, these conversations were rooted in a lot of common vision and already shared vocabulary. But I kept on wondering what would have happened if we had shared our theology with each other instead of talked about issues of racialization. We never talked much about religion, but in every personal conversation I had, and I had many, there were clear hints as to the wide diversity of religious views present at that conference. One woman, for instance, was wearing a veil. There were indeed practicing Jews and practicing Muslims, Christians of all sorts, from members of historic black churches to modern Catholics. There were atheists and Buddhists and self-described mystics and skeptics, agnostics, and even a few of none of the above. But we didn't ever label ourselves about our religious views or our spiritual understandings. We confined our conversations to talking about race and values around justice. We did not share with each other the ideas that ground us and strengthen us for this work. We did not talk spiritually of our ultimate concerns. If we had, I wonder if the conversations would have been as joyous or as delightful, as rich or as supportive. Maybe they would have. I don't know. Some years ago, when I was thinking about the different labels people use to describe themselves, religiously, philosophically, spiritually, I felt a moment of despair. If person A calls herself an atheist and person B says that he believes in God, isn't the chasm between them almost uncrossable? If someone says, I am a Jew, and another says, I am an evangelical Christian who thinks Judaism has been superseded by the mission of Christ, what possible grounds can there be to communicate at all? Sounds like a lot of tension without resolution to me. But during this conference, I thought, whoa, race issues have been a source of terrific tension all of my life. I've seen uprisings, and I've heard of shootings, and I've seen and witnessed shouting matches and observed racialization in our society of great subtlety, including liberals saying, I'm not a racist, but racialization of real consequence throughout my entire life. So has most everyone else who's lived in the U.S. of A. And yet here at this conference, I witnessed a great diversity of people talking about race issues with clear strength, clear vulnerability, deep listening skills, and insightful dialogue. There were no fights, no catcalls, no insults, no one getting up and turning their back. So I wondered, would it be possible for decidedly diverse people to also talk intimately and honestly about their theology? And could they find some common vocabulary so that the conversations promoting community could occur and that divisions would not? Last week, I gave an example in my sermon of the sad effects of a thoughtless theological conversation. This week, I'd like to offer some possible uniting vocabulary that might enable at least some folks to share their deep soulfulness with others without fear of being smacked back by someone who thinks they're theologically superior. And it's when I gave that sermon last week that I remembered the work that I did preparing for a world religions class that I taught at this congregation about a half decade ago. I was trying even back then to find some uniting words that would enable me to show real connections between religious human beings despite their differences, some commonality. And I didn't want to define religion using only that awful Western prejudicial spin that I hear so often, like when folks tell me that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are all religions because they talk about God, but Buddhism is just a philosophy because it doesn't speak about God. I have never been able to make sense of that statement, especially when I have watched my own grandmother light a candle in front of a statue of the Virgin Mary at her Catholic church, and only a few years later watched another woman, just as old and just as grandmotherly, light a candle before a statue of the Buddhist figure Kuan Yin at a temple in Oakland, both on their knees, both saying prayers under their breath. How is one a religion and the other one a philosophy? Sorry, I just don't get it. So eventually, struggling hard, I came up with the following three collaborative words: ultimacy, authority, boundaries. I said then, as I do now, that each religion and form of spiritual expression in the world, no matter how different and contrasting to each other, serve as ways that people, that human beings, talk about these three things. Working backward, here's a brief summary of my religion chart. Boundaries are many things. They could be a way of talking about food. No animal-based food, just fruits and vegetables. Or, don't eat any food at all for a while. Fast. Or, don't eat pork, just one kind of food, or shellfish. We identify boundaries when we say we worship on Sundays, or at Friday noon, or on Saturday morning, or Friday evening, not on other days. Or when we say, let's celebrate this holiday, but not this one. Or when we say, I will only marry someone who's never been divorced. Or I will only marry somebody of a different gender. Or I won't marry at all. All of these are boundaries. But in any case, no matter what your understanding about what the ultimate is or isn't, no matter what you believe about God, every human being has to confront keeping or crossing boundaries. And they make decisions about that. And authority, number two. Maybe you yourself are the final authority in religious matters. For you, many Unitarian Universalists share that with many Buddhists. Or maybe you posit a sacred scripture is your authority. The Book of Romans, the Adi Granth, the Torah, the Pali Canon. Or maybe you think a certain teacher or an elder or a guru is the authority, or the Holy Spirit making you quake in your body. But in any case, the spiritual life of every human being involves getting clear as to what or who you accept as an authority. But the one I want to talk about today is ultimacy. Can people of whatever religion or no affiliation at all speak to each other with kindness and even excitement about what is ultimate in their lives? Can you tell me what is final for you? Or in Paul Tillich's immortal phrase, what your ultimate concern is? If you listen to the first readings carefully, you would know that Mirabai, 500 years ago, the young Indian singer from Rajasthan, would have answered immediately, Krishna is ultimate for me. Krishna, the blue-skinned shepherd. Krishna, the one she claimed who was so strong he could lift mountains. Krishna, the presence of the god Vishnu on earth. Members of her family detested her for making Krishna ultimate and not their will and pleasure ultimate. According to legends, they even tried to do her in with poison and other intrigues. But Mirabai just sighed in pleasure before her ultimate one. Yet she claims in her poems that her ultimate one had abandoned her, wasn't there. Her poems are full of longing for a lover who is absent. Call me the woman whom separation has made insane, she wrote. Her god is gone, and yet she brims with love for him. And Mirabai writes about her longing with undeniable erotic overtones in poems that are still sung by millions and millions all around India in many languages, including languages Mirabai didn't even speak. Indian atheists know her songs. Worshippers of Shiva and other Hindu gods know her songs. Even worshippers of Kali, whom Mirabai refused to praise, know her songs and sing them. Yet deep in her poetry is something that leaps across into other hearts, including people who have rejected the traditional religions around them and all the names for God or for ultimacy. Something is deep that crosses those boundaries. And I, for one, find the exact same beauty and religious depth in the poem by Carl Dennis, Still Life. He does not offer us a name for ultimacy, like Mirabai does. He just describes, quite gorgeously, a bowl of oranges on a tablecloth with a vase of flowers and a book. A simple still life that might delight any artist. The people who have laid these objects out have a very clear sense of what is ultimate in their life, even if they deny any positive name for what that is. They make it clear. No plan for a heaven above, beyond, or within. Just this world, material and mysterious, is enough for these folks. Luminosity enough in the vast dark abyss of the universe. Their neighbor next door, however, might be on her knees praying to God for her sick grandson. That prayer, that love for her grandson, that God, together create the pattern of what is ultimate in her life. And yet I would like to suggest this morning that for me personally, there is no contest between any of these sincere expressions of ultimacy. Because what I learned at the conference on race I attended is that you do not build community or forge intimacy by confining yourself to labels and then just stopping there. Labels aren't wrong. Just don't stop there. I'm an atheist, you tell me. Fine, I say. What does that mean in your day-to-day life? What does that sense of ultimacy look like on Tuesday afternoon in a traffic jam, in the rain, at the bedside of your dying child, on the beach at sunset? The word itself, like the word racist, tends to stop conversation and any real communication that leads to deeper community if you don't pursue it. Same thing if you tell me that your name for ultimacy is the universe, or God, as you understand God, or Krishna, or the Dharma, or a higher power. Whatever name you give to what is your ultimate ground of all being, please, it's just a name. It tells me absolutely nothing. Honestly, it does not reveal anything about you. You are asking me to make assumptions, but I can't. Based on what? Based on the fact that I like you? Sure, I like you. But what does it mean when you say you pray? What does God mean in your life on a Saturday afternoon when you've been out of work for 2 months? When you have been in an auto accident? When you are sick and sick for a long time? What does the Dharma mean when you are despondent? When you feel erotic feelings inside of you that surprise you? How does your phrase agnostic inform your way of thinking about taxes or about immigration? I really don't know. You're going to have to talk with me. You're going to have a conversation with me. When you say you are a pagan, what does that mean? Like Marcus Aurelius? Like Epicurus? And you say you're a Christian. Already? But no, what does that mean? That smiling guy on television in the huge stadium church, Joel Osteen, claims to be a Christian, but Bishop Catherine Shorey of the Episcopal Church also claims to be a Christian. Which one are you most like? Why? I'm beginning to realize that if folks just use labels and don't explain what they mean by those labels, and if they hide behind those labels and don't have conversations about them with others, then no real deep community is possible. Dr. Powell went even further. He said that if you hide in your own individual life and refuse to share more than labels, more than slogans, then you are acknowledging to him that you are racialized as white. The spiritual centrality of individualism and the idea of the white race, he insisted, using sound historical data, were created in the same decade. That's a very deep idea, and disturbing perhaps, but I thought it important enough to bring up so that we might talk about what that might mean together over the coming year. Time magazine recently reported a study done about children and race. They found that children are racialized, that is, they become conscious of what race means, when they are still very young, even before they talk. They found out that the only way to address that disturbing reality was for parents and teachers and adults around them to talk openly and frequently and clearly about racial issues with their children as they grow up. I think the same thing is true in congregations like ours, where people bring many names, or no name at all, to describe what is ultimate for them, what is final for them, what their chief and central concern is, at least right now. And I add at least right now because Dr. Powell also reminded us that diversity is not just something that's evident in a room because of color of skin or color of hair or eyes or that sort of thing, but it's also found in each of us in our own hearts, inside of our skin, as we wrestle with fresh contradictory images on a daily basis. Another idea I found intriguing. In any case, I think that real and deep conversation is central, both for our understanding of what is ultimate in our lives, and whatever name we give it or deny it, but also for intimacy and community as well. When our universalist ancestors boldly proclaimed revelation is not sealed, they probably meant something like the Bible is not finished. There's more things to learn, I suppose. But I'd like to think that the phrase can also refer to ourselves. Self-revelation is not sealed. Sometimes religious progressives like to diss conversation, saying, we need to stop talking around here and do things, do something. Sorry, I beg to differ. The conversations we have about race and about what is ultimate are doing something. They are bringing us closer in intimacy, community, vision, and mutually supportive hope, just like the kind I felt deeply at the conference that Jolinda and I attended. And whatever actions proceed from such intimacy, community, vision, hope, and shared power will be grounded in an alliance far beyond the good intentions of any single individual, however self-defined. Well, at least that's where my mind and heart are roosting this morning.